this session. Okay, first of all, let me shortly introduce me. My name is Dr. Michael Petter. I'm a postdoc at Professor Seidel's chair, and I'm doing programming languages since approximately 4 years now. This is the first year that I do the lecture completely alone. The former colleague who did this with me the last few years has now left, so a few of the lectures might be a little bit unusual for me to give them also, but I'm sure we'll cope with that. So the overall structure of the whole thing, as you are probably already used to, you will have 12 lectures at minimum, depending on the bank holidays and extra things like me getting sick or something. So we will have, by our experiences, or at least 12 lectures. That will be a written exam in the end. And one thing I should warn you of is that for lectures like these here, we do not do any repetition exams in the winter semester holidays, also not in the summer semester. So if you're eager to do two exams, this is probably not the right lecture for you. Instead of of being able to pass a second time in this particular semester, you can do alternatively next semester the virtual machines exam or the compiler constructions exam. Also, we will once again give this lecture in next winter, so that that would be your possibilities to go for if you do not pass this winter. But if you follow the lectures and also come to tutorials, I'm sure that it won't be a big problem to pass the exam. What the lecture will be about is issues of designing and implementing different features for programming languages, also understanding how we bridge the gap between something which is quite high level as a programming language and quite low level, which is the machine on which a thing is running on. So we will be also having a lot of semantic insights into what we actually do. We have only limited time in this lecture for treating topics of programming languages, so we had to pick a few of them. And we happened to pick for once concurrency, because that is one of the important things in at the border of research right now. So concurrency is one of the major major things that we're going to talk about in this lecture, and also that we will have a focus on different techniques to achieve modularization of your software. So a little bit more in detail, what we will cover in our two parts is, for once, we will do concurrency with shedding light on how concurrency works between our high-level language and the bare metal. So we will have topics of low-level concurrency, especially why we need something like memory barriers. We'll talk about weight-free algorithms. We will talk about locks and monitors, and we will also try to talk about transactional memory if time still is enough for that. The next big thing we're going to talk about is modularization. So this will consist in how method dispatching works and what we can bring into languages with these kind of techniques. We will talk about multiple inheritance and what the implications on design and implementation of a compiler actually are. We'll talk about alternatives to standard multiple inheritance as we have it in C++, which would be mixins and traits. Then we will talk about languages that throw away the way that you specify classes and instead work with prototypes. So we will talk about prototype-based languages. There will be a focus on aspect orientation. And finally, if we have enough time, we will do generics and templates. So this is the rough outline of what we will see here. This won't be a course which is aimed at learning how to do each of these things on a high level, but what we want to do is understand what implications each of these structures that we know from high-level languages have on the implementation and what the semantics of these things actually are. So don't expect to have something like 30 days to learn C++-like event here. Instead, we will actually have formulas and theory in there. So be warned about that if you don't expect that. So apart from that, a few things about the actual organization of the lecture. You've already realized that we planned to start Wednesdays at 2:15. There will be bank holidays involved this winter semester. So there's, for example, one date, which is the 23rd of December, which is not an actual bank holiday. But I suspect that the audience will probably rely on the recordings instead of going actually here in our class. And yeah, I think that's not the purpose of meeting here, to just record everything. So yeah, I've decided to throw away this date. Also, we won't meet on the 30th and the 6th because these are actual holidays. So there's no lectures on these dates. If you want to obtain the slides, you can do so via the link mentioned here. You can also just try to navigate your way from just the top level. It should be quite easy to find. So this is the page to go if you're eager for the recordings. You can find them here, as usual. Okay. Next thing is exercises and tutorials. Well, I'm a little bit overwhelmed with the numbers of people that I found that have enlisted in this course. It's actually a one-person show here. So having 150 enlisted students is a little bit too much to do a tutorial in small scale, meaning groups of 10 to 20 people. So we will have to resort to the following thing. We will do a centralized tutorial session where we meet in a fashion like this one. Unluckily, we only have one slot where we can actually meet in such large numbers, which is overlapping with the program optimization courses tutorial session. I know, I have tried to get another rooms. The only room that I have actually been able to obtain, which was at another date, was too small. So at least for the beginning sessions, where we are still so many people, I will do the tutorial in here, in this Friday slot that you see in your campus online tool. And there's another slot on Thursdays, shortly after noon, which I will resort to as soon as numbers have decreased, because believe me, they will decrease. Last time we ended up with 30 people, starting from 100 enlisted people. So numbers will decrease, but it will need time a little bit, I think. So yeah. So for the first few tutorial sessions, we will actually meet in this room on Friday morning. As soon as we switch to the other one, I think I will give you a notice. Also, because there are such large numbers of people in there, I cannot do corrections on every sheet that you will submit. So what we do instead is we say that solving the sheets is voluntary but recommended. I will give you the chance to ask questions in the tutorial sessions where we will speak about the solutions of the sheets, but I won't do a graded correction on every one of them.
But will you publicize the solution?
Yes. So, that's. Okay. But as this is a programming language lecture, and programming languages are things that you need by that you learn by just doing hands-on programming, we understand that there's the need for you to do something. And for that, we will offer, well, it's probably on the next slides. So once again, for the tutorial sessions, we have one on Friday at 10 a.m. in this room, starting this Friday. You are supposed to have a look at the exercise sheets and try to complete them already at home. I will post the first of these sheets immediately after this lecture. And the solutions for these things we will gather here together in our tutorial session. And yeah, if you have questions, if you've found something which you could not understand well in the lecture, feel free to ask there. You can also ask in the lecture, as it will be the same person being there. So there's actually not so much of a difference in these two events. There will be a lot of interaction. I'm not sure whether that is so much helpful. There will be a lot of people asking and probably coming to the front. So I don't see how I can really make a meaningful recording of that. I'm sorry. Of course. And also the recordings of the slides. So yeah, that's something that's actually pretty good to record. So yeah, I think that's not a problem. Yeah, and for the last part that I have already begun to talk about was hands-on programming. There's two ideas that we want to do in this course. For once, there's the idea of giving you the chance to do a project. We will, well, as by now, we don't have the topics covered for the projects, so we will announce the projects as soon as we have the sufficient background to for you to start working on them. And you can, if you are interested in something like that, you can sign up for these, and you can earn a 0.3 bonus for your final exam with that. So that would be one idea of getting practice. The other thing is that after we have a few of the lectures and numbers have decreased, I plan to do something which is called an inverted classroom. This thing. Has anyone already taken part in something like that? Does anyone know what that is? Oh, okay.
A group of students or a student prepares one part of the lecture and presents it to the group.
That's one way of doing that. As we have recordings of the last years, what I will do is I will give you recordings of the topics from last year, so that you can watch them at home and also read the slides for that. And we will, in here, try to get together everything which was essential from the slides. That's where you come into play. You are to summarize and try to talk about what you have learned from that. And if there are still remaining questions, you can ask them. And then we are going to do hands-on on these topics. especially for these modularization things, I have prepared a few tasks to do together. There's also a virtual machine with all the necessary tools already installed, which you can obtain. You should do so probably somewhere in spare time. And then you can just bring your laptop and we can together try to make use of the things that we have learned in there. So that would be my idea of inverted classroom for programming languages. I hope you will enjoy something like that. That's a kind of experimental thing. I've done that never before, so I'm quite curious whether that will work for this setting. But yeah, I hope so at least. Okay, so this would be the formal things for this lecture. Yes, please. As soon as I cancel them, they are free for other courses to take. Okay. So we will. Yeah, you mean the 10 o'clock meeting Friday in the morning, or the Thursday 12 o'clock? Of course, I understand. Well, the thing is, I want to make sure that everyone who is interested in the tutorial talk has room to come. So my proposal would be to meet next Friday and we will see how many people actually show up. And if it turns out that people are still too many for the small room, we will keep the large room reserved, and I will, each time that we hit a certain size, I will remove the Thursday date for the next week. Right. That would be the idea for that. Is that okay?
So this week there is no
tutorial. Thursday is skipped until the group shrinks.
And this week on Friday?
It will be Friday by default from now on, until we say that it is changed. Because, well, I would really like to have the smaller room because it has more connections for power plugs. And if we start doing the hands-on parts, we will rely on having laptops and power for that. So, yeah, that's why I want to go into the other room where there's actually plug slots for that. Okay. Any other remarks, comments, proposals? Okay. Good. So let's probably change the slides to actual lecture slides. Yeah, that's a good chance to to go before being bored to hell. So for people sitting there, there's now room here, there's room there, room over there. So if you plan to stay, you can have it more comfortable than that. Okay. So let's probably talk a little bit about why we are covering concurrency in this programming lecture. Well, one thing that is probably not much debate about is that we will need to focus on concurrent features in program languages in the near future. Why is that? Well, if you just have a look at what the development of your underlying hardware actually yields is that, well, you have a large growth of the transistors in your systems. So there's that grows in an exponential way, and at least up to a certain point. This mainly resulted in an increase of the frequency of your processor, thus the speed of your computation could scale up by just waiting a little bit for the next generation of your hardware. And if your program wasn't fast enough by now, well, it would have been in a few years' time. That was how major manufacturers for hardware designed their developments. They could have, with the same amount of transistors, already built a system in the past where there would have been a lot of cores involved. For example, if you take these numbers of transistors, you could have had a 250 core machine already 10 years ago. However, there's a certain reason why something like that did not happen, and that is due to certain aspects. One of them is, for example, that most programs that you actually learn and the way you have begun to learn programming was not really parallel programming. You were, in most cases, you have started to program in a linear way without anything parallel happening in parallel. And that's a thing. Most programs are not really inherently parallel right now, because parallelization is something where you have to think about correctness and about scalability, and there's a lot of issues having an influence on how your program actually does in terms of runtime speed. So parallelization of programs has proven to be quite difficult or even impossible in some cases in a way that it is actually a speed up of your program. So that is one of the things that made systems with more processor cores unattractive. Also, doing communications between different cores is something which is actually challenging, because you have to use certain constructs on high level and on low level, and you have to think about all of them in order to get them to work. So there's low level aspects like the locking algorithms, which must be present and correctly implemented, which is that's something that has been developed in the last few years already, but even though it must be present. Also, there's high-level aspects like you have to worry about something like deadlocks, such that your program doesn't stall at some point. Yeah. Another thing is that even though you can write your code for two processors as well as for four, for eight, and so on, this is something that does not actually linear scale in a linear way. So if you parallelize your program on n cores, it will run by some factor speedier than before, but this factor won't be the same as your parallelization factor. So it will be slower than that, and in fact, it's actually quite hard to come in similar dimensions as as the factor that your hardware was scaled. So that's something that's bothering even more. So cranking up the frequency of your processor was something which was a lot more easy to achieve a speed up in the past. Yeah. However, times where the manufacturers would just crank up this processor speed are actually the past. Right now, the gains in processing speed in terms of frequency that operations will be processed these times are over right now. There's only minor gains in processing speed related to the clock rate in your processes anymore. This is reflected in the plannings, in the roadmaps of major manufacturers. So if you see like this, 2005, there was still there were still people thinking that you could scale up your processor frequency in the usual exponential way. 2 years later, you see that people were actually a lot more pessimistic and realized that the frequency increases that we had in the past are actually over right now, and people were then starting to concentrate on putting more cores on your machines. So that is the term that was characteristic for this behavior. The free lunch is over. We don't get an improvement of our programs by just waiting for the next generation architecture anymore, or at least not so easily. What we have to do now is we have to think about parallelizations and these things. Because, well, Moore's law is still holding for the number of processor cores that can be integrated in our CPUs. So, yeah, in order to make use of them, what we are depending on is that we need to make our programs parallel. So that's why we are going to think about what parallelism is creating as havoc in our programs, and how we can do, how we can make sure that we treat parallelism in the right way. So concurrency, from the programmer's point of view, what are the typical things that we are meeting there? Well, what we will do is we will spawn concurrent computations for once. And the other thing that we need to take care of is how to communicate between the different threads. And, well, this can happen in different ways. There's, for example, the communication via shared memory. That will be actually the focus for the next few lectures. There's atomic transactions on shared memory. This is something that we want to cover with transactional memory. And there's also systems like message passing, but I think there's more specialized lectures on that from other chairs. So what should be the learning outcome from the lecture here? What we're going to talk about is the happened before partial order. We'll talk about consistency models of your programs and hardware. And one of the important ones is sequential consistency. We'll talk about the actual internals of your process and how they affect the way that programs run on your machine. We will do that by looking at the MESI cache model. And as we see, when the cache gets more advanced, we will have certain effects that at first looked like random but can be explained with technical details. And this leads to another consistency model, which is the weak consistency model. And as one of the programmatical things that we introduce in order to achieve consistency in certain situations, we'll talk about memory barriers. So these will be the things that we'll be covering in the first few lectures. So let's talk about communications between cores first. So let's have a look at these two little programs. Give a little time to read. So there's not much happening in there. There's two threads, A and B, and one thread, thread A. What it's actually doing is it will write to two variables. It will write one at variable A and one at variable B. This is only has any effect If we know the initial state of the whole thing, the initial state of the program is assumed to be, well, that A and B is zero. What we also assume is that for thread B and thread B's program, we also have some kind of access to A and B, and what thread B actually should do is should execute a loop, this while loop here, and we will have a readout of variable B, and as long as variable B stays zero, well, stays its initial state, the whole thing will loop. So it's a kind of a spin lock. As soon as the state of the variable changes and the value changes, what we will do is we will exit this thing and execute the next thing, which is an assertion, and the assertion once again reads from memory, and this time it reads from A. So what is the big difference between these things? We have in thread A, we have the access to A first, and then there's B, and in thread B, we have the access to B first, and then an access to A. So, in general, if these two are running on the machine, what should happen there? Well, the assertion is something that rises either with false or true, but in this case, what is expected?
And we could always hope.
There's always hope because the.
Because, B is written after A.
Because, yeah. So the general idea would be here to that this assertion would always yield true, so that it will pass this assertion. Okay. Yeah, that's actually what's written over there. So. Yeah, so correctness for this program would mean that writing to A happens before before we can observe that one was written to B. So that is the basic thing that we get if we assume that strict consistency is happening in our systems, that. Well, it's not exactly this, but in the most strict way to think about correctness would involve that we emanate from a strictly consistent system, which means that a read operation from a location returns always the values that have been written by the most recent write operation to the same location. Why is that important for us? Well. Consistent ways of these two threads to interact with each other would be the ones seen with these process diagrams. So we have the two processes, foo and bar. I think foo was A, is it right? Yeah. So this was the old A. And this was the old B over there. And correct ways to for these to work would be that thread A spawns process foo and writes A to memory, and process B would then be there. And in a strict model, you would assume that these see the changes that have been the last to memory. So A is one now, but that doesn't that's something that's not of relevance to this read operation for B. Then, for example, let's say that our scheduler schedules another spin of our spin lock. So once again, we would read B's. Then there's another version of that, and then scheduler decides that A is working now, and then we will have a write access to B, and then the state would be changed. So that is only one way of the whole system to work. But what it actually keeps as a property is that the memory is accessed in a strictly consistent way. So what we see, if we consider the memory as one location, so to say, to access, then what we always see here in the same way is that if there is a write access to the memory at some point in time happening, then all the write access that come after that will see the same see this actual last change. So that is what strict consistency actually means if we take a memory model like this. However, this is something which is probably a little bit too too coarse for actual parallel programs. For once, one thing that makes the whole this whole notion of correctness a little bit difficult is that we now have a lot of different different situations that we have to cope with, because there's actually different ways to arrange these access patterns to memory, and also there's cache behavior in our processors that actually make situations like these unrealistic, because caches will mess up these access patterns. So this is some way of consistency that is not really helping in practical parallel systems. So what we are looking for would be something that is a little bit more is allowing more parallelism to actually happen. For example, what we would like to do is to decouple the accesses for different variables, because they can actually happen, or they should actually be allowed to happen in parallel in order to allow the implementations to move the operations a little bit around in order to create more parallelism, because that way that we have designed our memory model and our standard how we want the memory to interact with our programs, we will essentially create sequential programs. And that's what we don't want anymore with highly parallel architectures. So the idea would be to find another notion of consistency that is actually more applicable to the systems that we are interested in, which is these parallel distributed systems. And for that, we need to talk about something that is called the happened before relation. For that, let's have a look at how we can model distributed systems at all. You have already seen basics of that on the last slide. The basic components of of a model for distributed systems are, for once, processes. So we'll have a set of processes that we can name as we would like to do. And these processes consist of events. These events, in practice for our purposes, have been operations on our target machine. More generally speaking, these are more abstract things, which are just nodes in our process diagrams here. So what we can do with them is, well, for once we'll have the one process as one line here. And the events are appearing on this line in some meaningful way. Well, in our case, as we would apply these kind of systems to multiprocessor systems, then this would be operations of our target architecture, and the way that we arrange them would be determined by the high-level code that is running on this machine. So the way that operations appear here are determined by having a look at the actual code that is happening in a thread. And this way we would have, for example, things like read accesses to B, for example, would be events on there, and later on we would, for example, have a read access to A or something. So these are the basic events of these systems. And with these processes, we can model different things. For one of the examples was a thread of our system. We can also model memory. We can model memory locations. We can model caches. All different actors in such a system can be represented with these process diagrams. And we will refine the way that we model our systems step by step now when we talk about the different features that hardware is actually allowing. And these process diagrams will give us a chance to actually grasp what's going on between these components. So anyway, basic properties of these systems are that events that belong to the same process are inherently happening one before the other. Well, if these events are numbered, they have a little index with their number, and events with a lower number happen before an event with a higher number. So there's one happened before relation, or a source for happened before relation. And then what makes these process diagrams actually interesting is that we can also have messages sent between different events. So that there's actually happened before relations between different processes as soon as different components are interacting with each other. For example, if we model the memory with Q and process A with P, and we write A is 1, or we want to write to memory, then we will have the operation A is 1 as a first event, and this will send a message to the memory at some point and will trigger an event happening there. Namely, that memory will change to another value at that point. Okay, and in these cases, there will be a happened before relation between the two connected partners, and Q2 will happen after P1, or P1 will happen before Q2. So you have to take into account the direction of the messages. So the messages are directed. Okay, so this is distributed systems. So a little excursion now, because we need a few properties of our happened before relation now, and yeah, that's something that you can remember probably a little bit better if you make a comparison. So, Wandlor, is there anyone who does not know Harry Potter? It's always a difficult thing to talk from one generation to the next one to see whether the thing is actually still hip or not. Well, in this case, probably people know what I'm talking about if they have seen the movies or the write the books, and for everyone else, there are still the wikis that do the summaries of everything. So in these stories, there's a thing like a power of wands. If you use, if you have two magicians dueling each other, then there's they wield their wands, and these wands are have different powers, and these the powers of these wands is something that is comes not naturally, but is kind of following some laws. And this law is kind of written down in this wand lore. And yeah, we have a famous example in that. Yeah. I should have said spoiler, shouldn't I? Well, so probably ignore the actual people that's over there. But there's certain duels happening in the stories. For example, this one person over here, which I won't spoiler you if you don't recognize them, is actually dueling the other person over there. And what's actually happening is that we get to know that the power of this wand turns out to be stronger than the power of the other person's wand. So far, so nice. And later on, we will see that there's another duel happening with our main hero over here, and he then overthrows this small villain, and thus we learn that our hero's wand actually can overpower the villain's wand with that. This is quite a nice thing, because it turns out that it plays actually a role in this story, that there is actual laws involved when you wield such a wand, and it's not dependent on the power of the magician that you can overthrow someone, but it's depending on the power of the wand that you wield. And that's something that turns out to be quite crucial when we try to survive the large downfall of the good people here. And turns out that as you see, such a ugly guy that must be a real major villain in the whole story. He does not care for any laws or any theorems or any rules of your world. He just thinks that pure force, pure power of a magician is enough to overthrow everyone. So he disregards the actual laws that are involved within wands, and didn't recognize that actually through this chain of this success over here and this success over here, we have actually already found out that this wand is actually able to beat the mini villain's wand, and mini villain was able to beat this very fancy wand over here, which was then in the end passed to our top villain over here. And yeah, turns out that this was a bad deal, because that way our hero was able to overthrow the main villain. So what we should take away from that is the concept of transitivity. That is what played a major role in here and was not realized by this guy, which, well, yeah, you know, that's what happens if you don't know what transitivity is. Transitivity is not the only thing that's playing a role, because there's also the property of irreflexibility. Well, that's something as only one person can wield a wand. Well, that's probably something which comes quite natural. So irreflexible means that the wand cannot beat itself. So that's irreflexibility. And then there's also the property of asymmetry, which means that if the hero's wand can beat the fancy wand, then the fancy wand cannot beat the hero's wand, which is asymmetry. And all these properties together are called a strict partial order. So, that's what we get with wands beating each other. To beat is actually a strict partial order in that case. And now back to our happened before relation. That's exactly also what the happened before relation is. Happened before relation is also strict partial order. For, at first, well, it is partial, which means that, not every event may be somehow connected via happened before to any other event. So, that's the partial property for you. It is irreflexive, which means that, an event can never happen before itself. So, it's irreflexive. Then there's transitivity. If one event P is happening before an event Q, and Q is happening before R, then we will also know that P is is happening before R. Okay. Then there's also asymmetric. And asymmetric means that if P is actually happening before Q, then Q will never happen before P. That's why happen before is a strict partial order. Just as a side remark, what is strict referring to? Well, strict is, you can also have other partial orders which are not strict. In these cases, then we also get that our relation is reflexive, which means that the relation would hold between two identical items. That's something that we won't need here. For once, we also don't want that. So, non-strict is nothing interesting for us. It actually also gives, instead of asymmetric, the term anti-symmetric. And, that means that we need, if we have this reflexive property, we can have a nice test for the equality of two items. But that's just a side remark. What we actually are interested in is the strict partial order in that case, because that's our happened before relation. And with that, we can actually try to find events that may happen concurrently. And so we can have a definition of what concurrency actually means in our process diagrams. So, concurrency, what is it here? Well, two events P and Q are said to be concurrent if P is not happening before Q, and also Q is not happening before P, so they are completely unrelated. And if that is the case, we can call them concurrent. Is that, I hope that's clear so far. So can you spot two things that are actually concurrent in this diagram over there? Yes. R1 and P1? Well, good candidates. Those are the obvious ones where there's nothing happening independently of each other. So there. That's a good one. I didn't get them. P3 and Q3. So now there's a little bit of interaction going on between those two, but still, we have for P3, we have the happening before. If we take all of them together, we have these ones, and for Q3, everything that that happens before that should be in this set. So they are disjunct, and It's also concurrent in this sense. Okay. So that's what concurrency actually means in these process diagrams. We also have examples over there. Ah, P3 and Q3. Happens to be the same. Yeah, sorry for pointing that out. In order to get to our definition of what sequential consistency actually means, let's talk about finding a global order between all our events. That's what we are going to do here. We are introducing clocks now. What is a clock? A clock is essentially a function with a name. In this case, it is named C, that assigns a timestamp to each of the events in our process diagram. And a function is only then a clock if it satisfies the clock condition. What does the clock condition say? It says that if you pick any event or any pair of events in our process diagram, then if there is a happened before relation between those two, so if P, no, what's happening? Yeah. So if P happened before Q, then also our timestamps that we have computed from our clocks will be in the same or in a compatible order, which means that the timestamp for P needs to be smaller than the timestamp for Q. So that is the whole thing. Why is it something different than our happened before relation at all? Is there what makes it more special than the when the happened before relation? Sorry? For one? Yeah, but there's also one thing that I want you not to miss is that this property here. So we give each of the events a number with that. So that's something that's not given by the happened before relation. There's things that may be completely unrelated. So with a clock condition, we give a fixed we create relations in our clock that have not been in the happened before diagram. So it's one serialization of every event that's happening, even though they might be completely unrelated and concurrent in our happened before relations. Okay. Yeah. So in distributed systems, what are basic properties of the clocks? Well, if two events are events from the same process, then if they are already in the same process, they already have a certain sequence, a certain order, and our clock condition must reflect that. This means that the timestamps that are assigned to the different events of our one event, one process events, need to be compatible to the specification of this sequence. So, yeah, the clock must be compatible to each of the processes' event sequence. The other property that we need is that the clock must also reflect the message passing between the processes, but I think that's something which is quite natural. Okay. What we also have found is that as the clock is assigning a value to each and every event, we are now talking about a total order instead of a partial order. But what we have here is a total order that is compatible to the happen before relation, which means that it actually embeds all the relations that are expressed with the happen before partial order. So that's that. Yeah, and now what can we do with these clocks? Well, the set defined by all the clocks that that satisfy the clock condition, which means that they embed the partial order happened before. These are possible executions or interleavings of our distributed system. So that's everything that is possible within our model. So when we, or at least it's every interleaving, it gives us every interleaving that is possible for the this particular distribution of events for each of the threads that we agreed upon. So, yeah. The idea now would be to use this type of modeling to define a better consistency model than we had before. But anyway, let's probably try at first for ourselves to come up with a satisfying clock for our example here. So, any ideas for what I can fill in here? The idea would be now to give numeric values as results for our clock function. And we have to keep to certain conditions. Yes, please. Mm-hmm. So, for example, P1.
P1 is one and P1 also, if they don't have to be unique.
Well, it's probably... yeah. Sorry?
They could have it at the same time,
theoretically. Yeah. I think you could, for example, do something like that. Yes, this won't give you a complete complete linearization in that case, but I think let's probably do with different ones. But I think it would be without problems to use the same things, but let's keep to different numbers just to make sure that there's no interference in there. Okay, so you would say that the other starting points would also be easy. Low-hanging fruits here. So let's probably just do 2 and 3 over here. Okay, that's a good start right now. So, what else now?
We can just continue with the process P, because P2 just needs Q1 to happen before it, and Q1 has already happened at position 2, so we can assign the number 4 to P2. And then immediately assign 5 to P3 because P3 does not have any prerequisites except for P2.
Mm-hmm. So everyone got that? P2 needs to be larger than P1, and also there's a dependency over there. So there's 1 and 2, and we can then continue with the next free number, which is 4. So that's fine. And P3 just has one dependency, so we can fill in 5 over there. So that's fine. Okay, any ideas how to continue now?
Yeah, in a similar way, we can go on with Q and, push, for example, 6 to Q2, 7 to Q3, and 8 to Q4.
Mm-hmm. Why stop now?
Because Q7 needs R2, I think. I can't read it. But first, we
R2,
go
yes.
On with the R line, because Q7 needs, I think it's F.
Mm-hmm.
F2 first. So we have to go on with F first.
So R2 is our next, or P4, whatever. So it doesn't matter which one we take. So we can go on with R2, which is 11. Then is R3 okay to go on with? Probably, yes. So let's do this one. R4. Is that okay?
Yes.
And then P4? Oh, 14 and 15. So, anyway, I think that's... is there any objection to that? That depends on your optimization goals, so to say. So, of course, you could choose another.
If these processes get really long, then it might be better to.
From a scheduling point of view, you're completely right. You would probably have other goals in mind and other optimization functions. But in this case, there's not one clock that will be the solution for that, but it's just one function that satisfies the clock condition. So everything that's possible to construct within the limits of our happen before relation is okay. So we're not after finding one optimized solution, because that's something that is highly dependent on how the system is implemented over there. So so in this case, it's what you don't want is to emanate from too strong constraints on our thing. So that would be completely fine. Of course, if you were after scheduling, you would probably distribute it a little bit better. But what we're about to do here is talking about correctness, and for that we need to cover all valid things that do try to max out all the constraints that are only necessary. And for these, it's only the happened before that are really the ones that are our borders, which we cannot overstep. So, anyway, a meaningful useful way to do so, such a numbering is probably to, if you start with something like this, you probably want to what we're doing here is actually, has anyone realized what we're doing here? There's a name for that. Sorry? I didn't get that. Yeah, thinking in terms of graph algorithms. Well, we're doing a topological sort here. We have graphs. Well, they are a little bit hidden in there, because there's actually also kind of other edges over there. I mean, what we try to find is a numbering that reflects a way to go through this system. Well, if we take the means from topological sorting, what an actual way to implement a correct algorithm for finding such a sorting would be to start with things that don't have any incoming edges. So these things here are not really there, because there's no event to the left. So the only nodes in there that don't have any incoming edges are these P1, Q1, and R1. So we can take them, and take either of them for our start thing. And as soon as we give them a number, we remove them, thus removing also the edges that emanate from there and liberating other nodes from their incoming edges. So they might be new candidates for the next to give a number two. Well, the P2 thing is not completely liberated right now by removing sorry, P1 only, because we also would have to remove Q1, but we have also given it a number, so we can remove it together with its incoming edge. And this incoming edge, thus creating new nodes without any incoming edges. So that's the algorithm that you would probably use for that. So what you do there is finding a topological order for these things. Okay. Yeah, so I've done something like that for you here. This is pretty much similar to what you already have found, I think. It's just stopping at Q4 for some reason. Anyway, there are several solutions to that, and as you have already mentioned, it's not always the solution which does an optimal schedule for these processes, but well, each of them are actually valid interleavings of these processes. So that's what you should take away from these process diagrams. There's happened before relations between the events of each process. There's happened before relations between communicating events. Happened before is a strict partial order. What that is something we know. And the clock is a total strict order that embeds the happened before a partial order. So why did we bother to go through that lengthy thing? Well, what we want to come up with is a term for describing consistency on multiprocessor machines, which is a little bit more liberal than the strict consistency. To call the sequential consistency. And what is the general idea? We want to get inspiration from our process diagrams to model more relaxed memory models. And with these relaxed memory models, we want to actually try to model the fact that we are more liberal in our interleavings of processes than we have been before when modeling our memory just with one string or with one process. And what we will start with is, for example, that we will use one process for each variable in memory. And with that, we can concisely represent some interleavings. And for that, we need some kind of consistency term, and that's what sequential consistency is about. So there's one guy, this Leslie Lampert, who has come up with a quite neat definition of sequential consistency. This one is conveniently taken from Wikipedia, but this is also mentioned in a lot of the publications of Leslie Lampert. You can find them in the literature part of the slides. Anyway, what is the core thing that he says? He says that sequential consistency in a system means that the result of any execution is the same as if the operations of all the processes were executed in some sequential order, and the operations of each individual processor appears in this sequence in the order specified by its program. Well, that's rather lengthy and with a lot of words, and it can be kind of rephrased in a way that it fits to the things that we have talked about before. So, sequential consistency applied to multiprocessor programs. What does it mean? Well, it means that given a program with n different threads, when we look at a fixed operation sequence for each of the threads, so first, all that we say now is talking about one distribution of the operations on each of the threads. And this, we fix them with these events. And then we look at all the executions that that are compatible with the clock condition on these events. And sequential consistency means that if we have these two things, if we have fixed operation sequences on the threads and all the interleavings, which are meant by the executions that they keep the clock condition, that all these interleavings actually yield the same result. If that is the case, then we have a sequential consistency, a system which is sequentially consistent. So the important thing to take away is that there are several components involved. For one, we, if you think on back to these algorithms, each thread has several ways of arranging the operations over there, and there's variations possible, for example, in the number of times that a certain loop is executed, for example, and if you think back at the spin lock, for example, and before we start to think about sequential consistency, we need to fix what's actually happening per thread. So what we start fixing is which operations happen actually for each thread, which means that we, for example, fix the number of times that our spin lock actually does its query before it resumes with the assume afterwards. So that is something that is determined with a fixed operation sequence. And if we do that for each of the threads, and then what we do is we look at all the possible clock conditions, which means that we try to look at all the global orderings between these thread locally fixed operations, and what if we see that one interleaving is actually creating a different result than any of the others, then we will have proven that the system that we look at right now is not sequentially consistent. Proving the other direction is a little bit more hard because you cannot prove by a counterexample in this case. Theoretically, this is what sequential consistency is giving us. So in practice, what we can do with this kind of definition is that we can use it in order to disprove that a certain system is sequentially consistent. So what would be the technique for that? In the next few slides, we will introduce new features for our hardware model, and we'll also introduce these features in our process diagrams. And we want to see how these different features fare in terms of consistency. And the idea would be to start from our very coarse-grained model and take the execution in this model and also the resulting things of this thing, and then try to refine our model by introducing more fine-grained modeling of the components that are involved in that. For example, what we will do is we will look at different memory pages, or at least sort of, by separating the variables from each other. We will also, in the next step, then try to think of processor local memory in terms of cache lines. So we will multiply the memory lines by the number of threads, separating them, and thus introducing more fine-grained modeling. And then we will also come to a point where we will introduce store buffers and invalidation queues and all that, which will make the whole system even more detailed and even more complicated. But that's the way how we can talk about correctness of program for a parallel architecture. So anyway, that's what as soon as we find a situation in the more detailed in the more detailed model where we will, can construct a different result, then we will know that our sequential consistency was hurt in that setting with that program, for example. And yeah, that's a way for us to realize that an algorithm was not correct. So that's what we are going to do with this sequential consistency. So our first try to work with our new modeling tools is now separating the modeling of the memory into several processes, each one for its own variable. That's also a little bit of an over approximation in real systems. There will be more interaction between the memory pages because certain variables will belong to the same memory page than others, and others will not. But that's a level of detailedness that is up to you to do at home if you'd like. So, for purposes of showing here, is the first more detailed model is just separating the memory cells from each other and allowing more parallelism by that, because in this case, what we can do is we can, instead of before where we had to do all the memory accesses in sequence because we needed to keep book of who changed memory at the time. We need to track the sequence of memory accesses. In this case, what we want to allow is that now we can read and or even write variables in parallel, which we could not do before. In this case, we had to do it separately. So this is one way to model more parallelism in our programs. And what can happen here now is that we can write to our memory for a variable A from our foo thread, and our bar thread would meanwhile be able to query for the value of variable B several times. And at one point our thread foo would change the value to B1, thus introducing a happened before relation over here, which would have to be reflected in all the clocks that we set up for that system. And then our query for B would then afterwards go to a query for A. So, as it turns out, this is the point where we introduce a happen-before relation between these two processes, we can set up several clocks in these settings, but each of them will still come to the same result, at least for this sequence of operations for each of the threads. So these things are assumed to be constant. So what we can say here is that although we have made our memory more detailed, we still get sequential consistency for this model. Okay.
In this case, we have this loop where we try to read B.
Yes.
We don't really know how often that will happen, but you said we have to keep it fixed.
Yeah, because otherwise we will have a kind of direct proof that we have had another flow in our program, and this would assume that there's different things resulting from your computation. So in these cases, we actually want to have different results from our computations when the local sequence of operations is actually different, then we expect to have different results. So that's on purpose. But of course, if you have another distribution of or another sequence of operations locally, then you will have to restart the thinking.
Yeah.
So we really look specifically only at one distribution of operations on threads. Okay. Good. Okay. What is so good about sequential consistency? Well, the sequential consistency gives us a way to concisely represent all interleavings that are due to variations in speed. Well, you can vary the things that are happening in parallel. As you have seen before, it doesn't matter so much whether thread 1 accesses B and thread 2 meanwhile accesses A. That's something that you can vary with the context and with the actual speed of this thread. So all of them are represented in this one diagram. So that's something that's good, especially as synchronizing between processes via time is something. Well, if you have tried that at home as a beginner in programming, you will pretty soon have realized that that's something that doesn't work. Having one thread waiting for so much, for example, 5 seconds, and having the other thread also wait for 5 seconds, that will never give you a proper mean to synchronize them. That will always introduce errors. So synchronization using time is something which is quite uncommon. So what you need is some kind of synchronization due to some happened before thing which you can introduce with messages or something like that. So that's the way to synchronize between things. This is a good model for correct behaviors of concurrent programs, especially as if you don't have sequential consistency in your programs, you will have undesirable results, which are, well, in most cases when you have several ways to interleave your programs, which although they look similar in the thread local sequence, then if you have different results, you will have something which you consider to be a race, and that's something which is always undesirable in programs, or at least in most of the times. There's, of course, if you look at certain synchronization constructs with more abstract view, you will realize that in some cases you actually construct races in order to synchronize each other. But in general, what you don't want to have is a race, undesired races, places where races are happening without the intention to. And yeah, that's something that sequential consistency actually does not allow. It's a realistic model for older hardware, where where you have concurrent processes that have exclusive access to memory, and you can even introduce ways to distribute or to have thread local memory with caches, at least to some extent, and still maintain this sequential consistency. However, if you start to look at more modern features of processors which incorporate out-of-order execution and invalidate buffers, store buffers, and all of these things, then you will realize that having just sequential consistency without anything else is a little too coarse to come to a correct algorithm. But for that, we need to understand how caches work. So now that we have 3:45, and we are covering a new subtopic, I think we should finish here. Are there still any questions? So then I would say we'll meet again on Friday, and I wish you a nice 2 days.